As varied as our topography and soils, as rich as our resources, so varied and rich are the voices and stories of the folks around us. Come neighbor a bit with me, Sam Stroop. Grab a cup of coffee, pull up a comfy chair, let's get to talking. Last week, I began an almost two-hour talk time with Andy McMurray. His farm is located west of Boonesboro and overlooks the Missouri River bottoms. We discussed how he went to New Zealand and worked dairy and sheep farms there and brought back not just new ideas, but also a ram and six New Zealand ewes. From there, he built up his flock of 550 ewes. If you'd like to find out more about the apparel that his wool goes into, Google weatherwool.com. Let's get to talking.
Luckily, I have a really good consulting veterinarian out of state who also is a sheep producer, and he's also in an area with high summer rainfall, so he really understands. And he and I talk frequently, and I take his advice. I mean, if I got a problem, I call him. He tells me what to do, and I do it. Mm-hmm. And he knows. So
where is he located?
He's in Oregon.
Oregon, okay.
Yeah, he has a private. He's had several private practices, but he also has his own sheep.
And he's not in the dry part of the state.
No, he's in western, coastal. Yeah, he sure is. And he also sees a lot of goat customers. Mm-hmm. You need people like that. You need people that you can say, okay, they know more than me, and I need to be able to call on them to say what to do, because you get in tight spots, and mm-hmm. you need help.
What has his advice been for this summer where we've had this warm burst of wetness?
Depending on my grazing practices, that depicts, people always ask me, well, do you worm your sheep? I tell them, I worm them if they need them. If they need wormed, I worm them. It all depends on the situation. If I'm set stocked and they're able to graze contaminated pasture, I treat them different than if I'm able to rotate. So, if you own 100 acres and you have 40 paddocks and you can rest each paddock a minimum of 40 days and you don't have any get out, I wouldn't have to worm. And I've got groups of sheep I don't worm. But in summers that it's bad and when I don't have the ability to keep all those paddocks, I worm them according to a control protocol. You can't afford not to. You're losing production long before you see signs. Mm-hmm. So you have to treat it before you see signs. There's ways to do it, but you have to really study those worm life cycles and take your veterinarian's advice. And this year it's meant worming them. So like I say, if I need to, I do.
You're using the same wormer all summer now?
Yes.
Cydectin or type what?
I've used Prohibit Levasol for many, many years.
Okay.
And that's all I've used.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned rotating through pastures and praying that a few don't get out.
Right.
Because if they do and they get into a contaminated area, what happens? Is that a disaster then all of a sudden, or just...
I guess the few getting out wouldn't be a huge problem except for them. The problem typically, when people set up grazing systems to manage worms, typically they have a common area mm-hmm. that they always have access to.
Right.
Say a barn lot.
Right.
That's all it takes. Mm-hmm. You have to have...
Now, why? Because they're not eating any grass there.
Because they are attracted to the regrowth. The regrowth is the short grass close to the ground where it's more moist, where the worms are more abundant because it's more moist. So if you had a super tight woven wire system of, say, 15 paddocks minimum, mm-hmm. Each paddock has to have shade and water, too, which is a huge... And you could rest at least 45 days... and not have them on any one of those pastures for more than about 3 days, you've completely managed the worm problem. Mm-hmm. And if you can arrange that, if you can invest, that's the mistake I made. If I had the $3 million farm with those improvements, I wouldn't be worming sheep, and we'd be able to have a vacation, and we'd be making a lot more money because they'd be more healthy.
So your buddy out in Oregon says 3 days on a paddock.
So the auto reinfection happens at about 5 days.
Okay.
So fresh droppings will...
explode.
...will contaminate a pasture at around 5 days. Okay. Well, you have to put in a little bit of buffer, so you shouldn't go more than four. Mm-hmm. 3 would be better.
Yeah, I'd been hearing 5 to 7 and probably making the mistake then of leaving them there 5 days when I should move them on day 4.
And then if that...
Now, usually they move themselves on day 4.
Right. That pellet then has most of its infective larvae killed, most within about... after about 45 days,
yeah.
But not all. So if you could go to 60 days, it'd be a lot better.
Yeah. I've got 10 paddocks, and I figured I needed 2 more, but in fact, I need about 7 or 8.
It takes a lot.
Yeah.
And if you've got multiple groups of sheep, you have to multiply it. Yeah. So typically, the main thing I learned in New Zealand that I wasn't able to implement was you have to have a farm set up. And most of those sheep farms would have 20 to 60 such paddocks.
Mm-hmm.
Each with water and shade, right. And each completely sheep tight.
Yeah,
that's part of the farm. Mm-hmm. That's their combine,
right.
Or that's their,
right.
You know, it's fence and
now
gates.
How is their fencing different? They didn't have electronetting over there, did they?
That would all be permanent fence.
Okay.
On the sheep farms, primarily, mm-hmm. It'd be permanent. The dairy farms would use more of the portable,
right.
Electric.
Yeah.
Sheep farms would use some, but not as much. The average sheep farm in a climate like ours would have that many.
Yeah.
Paddocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been working with woven wire, 32-inch,
yeah.
With one hot wire across the top.
It's a huge investment.
Yeah,
and
not as bad as I thought it'd be. But, 400 acres, I suspect we've put about $9,000 into fencing.
Yeah.
Compare that to a combine.
Right. No, absolutely.
It's nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I do need more.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And then we also have the problem with the goats of they can't handle cold, wet.
Right.
So they've got to have housing because you're still out there grazing into December. Of course, the worm problem isn't as bad in the fall and winter, I wouldn't think. It'd probably be a longer period of time for the worms to pop out if it's cold.
Well, it's
not.
A different species of worm with sheep anyway. It's a black scour worm.
Hmm.
Can be a problem. Or coccidia. That's even worse. Yeah.
Will coccidia, how long a time frame before the coccidia disappear in an area?
I don't.
Maybe 2 years.
I don't know. I think it reaches a point where it's almost permanent.
Yeah.
I think coccidia is pretty, and it's harder to treat than the worm, than the stomach worms.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was another thing that Dr. Dietrich helped me figure out was how to manage the coccidia risk. Typically, sheep and goats, you know, they're a desert animal.
Mm-hmm.
And we're raising them in, you know, we've had 60-inch rainfall years.
Right. What are you working with to attack coccidia? Some kind of a...
You can put coccidia stat in their mineral, in their salt.
Okay.
Which is sort of a standard. So typically it's the lambs. Until the lambs get challenged by that, they don't have immunity.
Right.
So when the lambs are young and if it's muddy... I'll put that coccidiostat in their mineral. But I have to, ideally you would do that, you would feed that to the ewes starting at six weeks before lambing or kidding.
Okay.
Pipestone Veterinary Clinic in Pipestone, Minnesota has a protocol for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they say 6 weeks prior to lambing or kidding, you start the...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure coccidia are a dilemma for us that we haven't even started to attack.
It will grow it will increase every year on a farm, and that's what got me. I had a couple of years where I had outbreaks, and it was because the population in the soil had increased.
How many ewes did you breed and lamb out this spring?
About 550.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that high, or are you down some from some of the
I've
past,
increased
or?
Every. I've increased some pretty much every year since we started.
At what age do you bring? Can you breed yearlings? I mean,
I've started getting some that will
yearlings.
Lamb at around a year old.
Okay,
and I'm emphasizing that type.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my new.
And that's because mama's done a good job of milking. You've had excellent forages, or are you taking them aside and giving them
no, they
them
have to do
grain?
It. No, they have to do it totally on their own in the same system.
Mm-hmm.
Years I get better cover crop, I'll have more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that also is another disease, Campylobacter.
Mm-hmm.
So in a season when it's really muddy, you'll have a lot of pregnancy failure because of that Campylobacter. And we had a muddy winter last winter, so I didn't get as many ewe lambs to lamb. But you can vaccinate for that. I just have never vaccinated lambs yet, but I'm going to start vaccinating lambs.
So the ones that you get to lamb at a year of age, you're breeding them about the 1st of January?
No. Well, some of them will breed. So typically on the cover crops, the lambs, I'll start seeing breeding late October, even in some cases.
And what would they weigh then? 60?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And up 60 to 80, probably. That's sort of when they start.
Mm-hmm.
There's...
But I thought you tried to get everything to lamb in May.
The ewe lambs are different. I just take them.
Okay.
Yeah. The ewe lambs that happen to lamb early like that, I just take it as it comes.
Okay.
If they do it, great. I identify them and I'll bump them into the stud group for getting rams off of them because that's the trait I want. I study the genetics quite a bit and have quite a few colleagues around the world on the genetic side of things, but a lot of traits conflict with each other. So if you want a huge, lean sheep, you're going to lose fertility. If you're okay with a smaller, fatter type sheep, they're going to go through puberty earlier and they're going to breed and have more lambs. So you balance what traits you want.
I see.
And there's a lot of new research coming out talking about productivity, a lot of new findings. A lot of times the most productive, profitable individuals are more moderate in size.
Mm-hmm.
With merinos, it's especially complicated because you're managing two different crops simultaneously. So you've got the wool you're managing, and you've got reproductive and growth rate you're managing. So you're managing three different. Mm-hmm. And some of those traits conflict with each other.
You know, you're wearing my head out thinking about all the things you have to keep in mind all the time.
I enjoy it. I enjoy it. I guess when you're, weird like I am, you enjoy the... And it helps having mentors that know more than me that I talk to frequently, mm-hmm. and we compare notes.
Yeah.
But there's one phenotypic ewe type within Merino that I'm discovering is superior for reproductive. And I'm talking to colleagues around the world about this at the exact same time that they're finding it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scientists are researching it. And sure mm-hmm. enough, so we have this phenotype now.
Wow.
If they have that look, they're highly likely going to be superior for maternal traits. And it was just that all kind of happened in this conversation. Anyway, it's really exciting.
What kind of sort of things are you seeing in that phenotype?
So in merinos, you don't want wrinkle. Wrinkle is negative for prolificacy. Fat.
Wrinkled skin.
So they measure fat. And they have a breeding value for fat. It's highly variable between individuals how much fat they maintain on mm-hmm. their body.
Mm-hmm.
And that fat is essentially a haystack that they wear on their back.
Uh-huh.
Anytime there's stress, if they're fat, they make up for it with that fat. If you look at desert breeds of sheep, there's fat tail sheep.
Right.
And in the spring, their tails weigh 50 pounds.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have abundance of feed. Right. Well, all summer long during the drought, they feed off that fat.
Mm.
And they're adapted to their environment. So they measure fat with ultrasound. And they have a breeding value for fat.
And a wrinkled sheep doesn't have much fat?
The wrinkle is a separate trait.
Okay.
And they don't necessarily understand that. They just know there's a strong correlation with wrinkle and low fertility. Mm-hmm. So there's no wrinkle, which is nice because I hate wrinkles anyway. There's a whole bunch of problems with wrinkles.
Mainly in when you're trying to take the fleece off.
Shearing and also external parasites. They're more susceptible to external parasites.
Yeah.
I just don't like the way they look. And they tend to have a more wool-free head and legs. So they tend to be more bare on the face and head and legs. And they tend to be a modest size. So
do you have just a few of those or a third of your ewes looking like that now?
Maybe 10%.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you'll lean heavily towards them.
Well,
you've maybe discovered something.
I'm not making breeding decisions based on how the phenotype looks yet.
Okay.
But I'm watching those ones closer, and if they prove themselves, then I'll bump them up.
Right.
But the conflict between wool traits and meat and reproductive traits, it's a very real tension, and the balancing of those two traits is really tricky. Humans tend to push extremes, and you start pushing extremes with two conflicting different traits, and you'll start creating unintended, unwanted consequences. So it's fun learning that dynamic, and there's lots of research going into it that I get to read about.
Isn't it amazing how a farmer can use the internet anymore?
Right, it is.
And communicate to each other through it.
It is. Yeah, it's a crazy...
We are the new research. We can be the new research focus of the world just by staying in touch.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I'd like to discuss before we quit a little bit about what's going on with the marketing. When do you shear?
Balance, and that's the other balancing challenge, is how much time gets allocated to marketing versus raising sheep. And they have to both work, and they have to both work really well. And typically, I'm more attracted to raising sheep, and I don't spend as much time with marketing as I should. But typically, we'll shear between March and May. Most of the wool.
Get it done before they have lambs.
Right.
Yeah.
Needs to be done before they lamb. Most of the wool will get made into 500-pound bales and shipped to an auction. The fleeces that we want to sell on the internet to fiber art hand spinner type customers go in bags and get sorted and sold primarily by my wife, who sells them on the internet with photos. And that's fun. You get to meet a lot of people.
Sure.
But it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Who helps you? You don't do all the shearing yourself.
I have a shearer I hire, and I also do some of the shearing myself, depending on the year.
So you have one guy that comes up and helps you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where is he from?
So he's from Callio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is he faster than you?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's a professional. I'm an amateur.
Okay.
I enjoy doing it, but it's really hard to get time allocated to do it.
Mm-hmm.
For years, I did all my own, and after the numbers grew to a certain point, I couldn't keep
What is
up.
The shearing season for him? Does he start in February?
Yeah, that's about right. I think February through probably June.
Finishes up on you.
June or July. No, I'm one of the first ones he does,
really?
Actually.
Okay.
I'll sometimes start shearing in February.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you market this down in Arizona, the bulk of your wool?
There's a wool broker warehouse in New Mexico.
Okay.
Yeah, Roswell Wool.
Mm-hmm. I've been told by your dad, and maybe he's exaggerating, that you've got some of the best wool in the United States right now.
Probably so. Yeah, that's probably pretty accurate. You know, there's certainly flocks that are as good and some that are a little better, but they also have a much better climate. Typically, wool in particular needs a drier climate. So the fact that I can grow the kind of wool I do in this climate, I'm probably more proud of that than I am of just about anything else. And that's a result of just all those years of selection.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a common trait at all. Typically, you don't grow wool in these areas. And typically in our area, hair sheep, no wool at all, are becoming more popular.
Yep. Are you rewarded for the quality you get?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Yeah, I am. I would like to be rewarded more by adding value to it and selling retail product. Unfortunately, that's a huge undertaking. I need another business manager to take that on.
Right.
But that's one of the passions I have, and I do work on that.
Now, you did try that, but you aren't doing any weaving
now,
mother, are you?
My mother was weaving for a while. We were selling items in the 90s before. Mm-hmm. So there's a farm-to-table movement.
Right.
Well, there's also a farm-to-fashion movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really big right now. And if we had done what we did 15 years later, it would have been a massive success. And we had quite a bit of success even then, but it became obvious that the magnitude of management of that would consume us. I mean, it's just a huge undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
And until I have a business partner that can do the bulk of that, then there's just no way. So we sell to hand spinners on the internet, and we sell large commercial lots that goes to commercial mills made into clothes.
Patrick was my son. He knows more than I do about so many things. He says, yeah, Dad, wool is coming back in the United States. For so long, it was being ignored, but it's coming back. But the bulk of your wool is probably going overseas, isn't it?
Well, China controls 75% of the world's wool, in particular the fine wool. It's a bigger industry than beef. Globally, wool value at the retail level is bigger than beef.
Amazing.
And we used to have a big wool industry in this country, and it's all been outsourced. Mm-hmm. So it's all in Asia. Or not all. There are a few mills left, but by and large, it's been outsourced. There's such an explosion of value from a fleece to a garment in a store.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you might get $2 a pound for a steer, but a steak is never going to cost $100 a pound. Well, with wool, it goes from $4 a pound to, you know, $3,000 a pound before it hits retail. So there's just this massive explosion of value, most of which is captured by everyone in the industry except the grower. And it's sad because wool is becoming more popular by consumers, but at the same time, world production of wool is declining. And it's hard to say how this is going to play out. I don't know.
So the Chinese are buying massive amounts of wool. They manufacture clothing out of it. And a lot of that is being exported back out of China?
To us.
Or to the Chinese?
To us. Most of it comes here.
So the Chinese aren't necessarily the people wearing all the wool.
Right. No, it goes to China, gets made, and comes back as a retail product.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is part of that probably because they have cheaper labor?
Originally it was that, but now it's also high tech.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sure. They could be doing the same thing.
You know, we've gone from a country that produced to a country now that just kind of trades money around. We just pass money around in a circle, whereas the Chinese wanted to create.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they get that industry. I don't know. It's the most interesting part of that to me is the fascination by the hand spinners. They want to understand the process of making clothing. They want to buy a fleece from us and hand spin it into yarn and knit that yarn into a hat because, you know, they just want that experience.
Right.
At the same time, what we're really wearing in mass is done. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a Wendell Berry. How's that? He says it. I don't know. Just the idea of the revolving cycles.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of ladies that buy our fleeces will spin yarn. They'll make a shawl for a sister-in-law or a sister.
Right.
Or a lot of times their mother's elderly and wants a shawl to wear when she washes. So these become heirlooms that are handmade and they're priceless. It's not really just clothing. It's more of a, if you think of children with their favorite blanket, they become attached to it. I think as humans, we kind of do that all along. And when we get older, you know, we have a lot of elderly people that really appreciate their wool. And we get a lot of really neat stories about handmade items that have become family heirlooms made with wool. Wool is one of the most durable fibers there is. Some of the oldest textiles in museums are wool, just because it has the ability to last so long. So wool has become more of a luxury over the past 20 years, whereas prior to that, it used to be more of a staple. And the other big push right now is because of the contamination of microplastics in the ocean. All of your synthetic clothes, they're the worst contributors to microplastics of all, because every time you wash a polar fleece, all that microplastic breaks off and goes into the sewer system, ends up in the ocean, ends up in the fish we eat. And wool is a biodegradable fiber, so you don't have that problem. So that's one of the huge appealing parts about wool right now. It's much more environmentally friendly.
It is going to be so interesting to watch this trade war thing with China. Interesting, maybe not. That's not the good word over the next 15, 20 years. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, I've seen China. I've seen Hong Kong. Those people are smarter. They work harder. This challenge that America's got going with them, we're going to see how it plays out. It's going to be very interesting.
There are a couple farm-to-fashion brands that are uniquely American, and it's really exciting. Duckworth is one in Montana. Several years, our wool has gone to one called Weather Wool. They have a great line of outdoor wear made with hard wool, and they're based in New Jersey. Both of those brands are 100% USA grown and manufactured. There's some others starting up. So I hope to see more of that happening, and it's certainly rewarding to serve them, you know, with selling them the wool. American Woolen in Connecticut was recently purchased. It's a whole town centered around this historic wool mill. Huge wool mill, and they're starting an American brand. They're worth looking up. They have the potential to be a very big player. There's several links on our Facebook fan page, Geno Palette, that have videos of these different mills and these different brands, because I like to feature these success stories.
What is the average poundage of wool off one of your ewes?
Probably. That's another one of those traits that can hurt you if you push it too much. Probably about 8 pounds average per sheet.
Yeah.
So the weather wool, one of their more popular items is a coat. Probably could make two or three of those coats from a single fleece.
Amazing.
Maybe four. Mm-hmm. And they're $1,000 retail.
Wow. And you keep some weathers just for wool?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that would be ewe fleeces. So those are ewes that also raise a lamb or two lambs.
Do you market so that you're taking wool off the lambs that you will be marketing as?
Yes, shear them before I sell them.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. And they maybe make 4 or 5 pounds?
About half, fleece? Yeah.
Okay.
Well, two-thirds.
All right. Yeah. And when you said weather wool, were you referring to them?
Oh, that's a brand, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Weather like... it's raining weather.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, weather wool is a brand.
All right.
American-made brand that's used our wool in their line.
Okay.
Really a neat company. Hmm. Worth looking up.
Mm-hmm. Going now to the other side of your marketing, the lamb.
Right.
When do you market them typically?
When they're big enough.
Okay.
Since I raise on pasture, grass-fed, they'll grow according to what feed they have, so right. It varies. But anywhere from Thanksgiving through April, May, so we'll mm-hmm. sell in loads of, we'll sell in gooseneck loads.
Where do they go?
They're sold to U.S. Wellness Beef or U.S. Wellness Meats out of Monticello, Missouri.
Okay.
And he sells the retail cuts over the internet, along with several other local sheep producers, mm-hmm. lambs. So
you're probably selling, 800 lambs?
Not that many. Okay. I've been keeping replacements, and I sell some replacements.
Yeah. How do you work that? Who do you decide to call? Do you just automatically, this animal has given me 5 lambings, she's gone?
Typically, it seems like the ewes produce pretty well up until not long before they die of old age.
Okay.
I don't have a real aggressive culling program.
Okay.
It's not a real good market, and usually by the time they're ready to cull, they're ailing anyway, and I just let them retire.
Yeah. What is the high point for the value of the lamb? Is it like February?
So with my buyer, it's a flat. It doesn't change. Okay. The price is set. Yes, it's a verbal contract. Right. And that was a real breakthrough to have that stability.
Yeah.
And he's a great buyer, great company. Very different than selling at the sale barn or mm-hmm. selling, you know, the commodity route.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the retail level, the consumer price doesn't change much.
Right.
But the farmer gets yanked around, mm-hmm. you know, it's a messed up system.
Yeah.
It really is a messed up system. And someone in that supply chain has to man up and say, we need a better system. And in the case of U.S. Wellness, you know, they have a set retail price for their meat. Why can't they make a set price they pay for the animal? And they do it, you know, they just do it. So it takes leadership, and that's what's lacking in so many cases. You know, commodity price being below the cost of production 2/3 of the time. I don't know. It's frustrating.
Yeah. Well, I hope I haven't wore you out.
No, obviously.
But just a couple questions so people know who you are.
Yeah.
How did you and Desiree meet each other?
So... my brother Patrick, my oldest brother, is 10 years older than me, and Desiree's sister Monica married. So, and she's about 10 years older than Desiree. So my brother and I married sisters.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So we met mm-hmm. as a result of...
Yeah, family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you went to high school at Glasgow?
Yep.
4 years?
We moved to this farm when I was in fifth grade.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went fifth grade through graduation at Glasgow.
Now, you have done a lot of homeschooling.
Yeah, we've homeschooled our kids, our four kids, yeah.
What were your reasons for doing that?
The rural school was really a huge windfall for me. The community was smaller. Mm-hmm. People were more people-oriented. Yeah. There wasn't a big academic achievement kind of pressure. I wasn't interested in that, so I was a hands-on learner. So suddenly I went from being defective in Columbia to just being a kid in Glasgow, and I loved it, and I flourished. I did really well. So I was really grateful for the rule. So I'm really careful not to criticize teachers. I love yeah. teachers, and I love the vast majority of teachers are awesome, awesome people that I've met. The system, I think I feel for them too, because I don't like the system of a lot of public education. I think it's getting better. And since it worked so horribly for me personally, and to a certain extent, Desiree as well, we wanted to try something different. Yeah. And two of our kids have had, so Fiona went for her freshman year at Glasgow, and Mira, our daughter that's now 16, will be starting her second year at Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. And you have two sons also.
Yeah. My oldest son, Ewan, is living in Texas. He didn't go at all. And Kevin, who's 11, hasn't gone yet, but he probably will at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the son in Texas doing?
So he's a barista, and he's studying to be a social worker.
Okay.
At University of Texas.
Yeah. Do you get down there to see him, or is he?
I haven't been able to yet.
Yeah. I have a son in Houston. Yeah. We hate going to Texas.
Really?
The traffic, the heat, the humidity. We were much happier when he was in North Dakota. We loved going up there.
Yeah. He and his girlfriend want to move back to Kansas City eventually.
Mm-hmm. What school is he working with in Texas?
University of Texas.
Okay. Yeah. And that's at?
Austin.
Austin.
Yeah.
Okay. And you did some foo painting for a while.
Well, I worked as a contract painting interior finishes contractor most of the same period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So from 88 until it really slowed down after 2009, I did subcontract painting work,
mm-hmm.
primarily interior.
Yeah.
And
by not doing that now, has that meant you've slowed down, or the sheep are taking more of your time?
The sheep are taking more of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you miss about the painting? Anything?
The steady income.
Yeah. Yeah.
With sheep, there's long periods where there's, mm-hmm. you know, cash flow issues.
Yeah. Do you and Desiree get time to travel?
We do not.
We do not either.
No.
We're all excited. We're actually going to the Farm Aid concert
yeah.
in East Troy, Wisconsin in September. That'll be the first getaway in quite a while.
Well, since she wasn't raised in ag, she's somewhat... It's nice having the contrasting backgrounds. I think if she was as ambitious on the farm stuff as I have been, I don't know that it would have worked as well. There's a check and balance there, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean it's easy either.
Yeah.
I enjoy the work very much. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the animals, the plants, the soil, but there's a lot that goes on in a business
yeah.
other than those things.
And her joy has been raising the kids.
Right.
And helping
She's an artist, so she does
uh-huh.
a lot of writing. She's a poet and a photographer.
Mm.
So she makes us look and sound good and creates her art along the way. And she's done the bulk of the homeschooling, which has been critical. And in my opinion, very successful, to her credit, not mine.
Yeah.
I've taught the kids basically just by them watching. You know, you have to work. So our kids have a work ethic
mm-hmm.
just because, I think mostly because they see that we work. It's not so much we make them work, but they just... see it and know it. So the older two that have been out on their own have been able to have some of that to their advantage, I think.
Mm-hmm. Did they work with you with the sheep?
Some, or? Yeah.
Okay, some.
But not as much as I work
okay.
In my family's growing up. However, they were always immersed in it. You know, at home,
yeah,
it's a 24/7 thing.
Right.
So they're always immersed in it. And they always help when I needed. But I've not demanded it.
So you kind of do feel, though, that their work ethic came from observing you and your wife's work there.
I think so.
Interesting.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I have several friends and family members that are social workers. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm really interested in psychology. I really enjoy reading psychology-related research and science. And in couples counseling, they say 99% of communication between couples is nonverbal. And it's really true. Hmm. You know, so I think with kids, I think raising kids is the same. I know a lot of times we'll all talk a lot at each other and none of it means anything.
Yeah.
Because we'll still go about doing it the way we always did it for whatever reasons.
Mm-hmm. My boys are extremely hard workers and they're known for being stroops and they'll get the job done for you. And I always figured it was because we worked hard together as a family. So this is very interesting for me to hear that it can also be caught by observing hardworking parents.
Yeah, I the sheep and the farm enterprise was so much my thing all along. Mm-hmm. And I was so intense about it that I didn't want, and they didn't want to have that imposed on them. So I tried to give them that freedom. And they may say that totally differently.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So what I observe in Armstrong, because I've been very involved with the families and youth up there all my life, is they tend to be families that are supposedly disabled.
Right.
So the children do not see working parents. Hmm. And when I get those kids down to help me, they should be paying me for the privilege of being around me because they are totally worthless as workers.
Yeah.
And I think it's because they never saw anybody work.
Yeah.
I remember giving a broom to a kid once and saying, hey, this mess on the floor has got to be cleaned up. Would you sweep it for me? He had no idea how to handle a broom. Wow. I mean, it was the most comical sight you ever saw. Wow. He did not know what to do with that thing.
Wow. To me, the biggest thing with raising kids are you're going to make mistakes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so I'm always looking for what mistake. I'm kind of neurotic. And just being able to say sorry, you know, is so huge.
Yeah.
And it's so hard sometimes. But one mistake we made, our oldest daughter, Fiona, she really took matters in her own hands when she was nearing her last year of homeschool. She made plans to travel abroad, volunteer in Scotland. She found a university that would give her a huge financial aid to become a nurse. That all went really well. So after her senior year of homeschool, she's off to Europe by herself. And it all went really well. And, you know, for us, there was some grief because here she's flown the nest. It was a delicate balancing act of saying, well, how much do we dote? How many times do we text?
Yeah.
Or do we just let her do her thing? Mm-hmm. Well, we ended up kind of letting her do her thing. And then she gets home. She's at her first year of university. And since she was homeschooled, she never really had that kind of schooling environment.
Huh.
And we were kind of just letting her have her space still, because when she was in Europe, she was fine. I figured if she could travel in Europe by herself, college is going to be a breeze. Right. Well, she had a hard time, and she was wondering why we weren't contacting her more. So that was really, she's the quieter of the family, and that was kind of sad. It took her a while to speak up and say, hey, why don't you guys come see me here? So that was pretty sad.
Was she here at school at Fayette?
No.
College, nursing school?
No, she's in Kansas City.
Okay.
So that was a mistake, right? I didn't stay in touch as much as I should have. And each kid is so different. Some of them will, they'll scream every little need they have every second they feel it. The other ones won't ever say they need anything. So you can't make a formula. You have to deal with each one. You know, we thought we were doing the right thing by giving her space, and she wanted us to reach out more. So
it's really fun talking to your adult children now and getting their reflections on how you did at raising them.
That's funny. Yeah.
A couple of anecdotes. My oldest son said, Dad, you were amazing how you got work out of us. You'd get us together and you'd say, okay, there's four of us here and here's the four jobs that need to be done.
Yeah.
Who wants to do which one?
Wow.
And we always took the best ones and you always got the crappiest one, Dad.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, but we got all four jobs done, didn't we? And then another compliment they've given me, they'll say, Dad, you're just amazing. You're always trying new things. And the amazing thing is 1 out of 10 times they work.
That's actually, You know, the farm machinery brand Vermeer.
Yeah.
Vermeer, Iowa, they have a museum where they share their successes and their failures.
Mm.
And the founding people of that company say something along those lines, something like 9 out of 10 of your attempts should fail, or you're not pushing the envelope hard enough. So I think that's how we learn. Yeah. You know, we make mistakes.
Well, we've pushed the envelope on our farm.
That's You've got to.
We tried sheep for a while. And our two things was we didn't have we had a dog, but it became the children's pet.
Yeah.
So the predators just decimated us, and we couldn't figure out fencing.
Yeah.
And between the two, it lasted. We had 200 ewes. It lasted 2 years, and then we got out.
It's a very specialized skill set. And unless you have a background or mentors, and our industry is basically dried up.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to have that training, that support. Mm-hmm. Just even knowing what equipment's available, or like this thing about the drugs and the technology for managing worms. I don't know what's going to happen in our industry. I don't have a real good feeling about it.
And the information that is there isn't getting out. Because when I look at the Goat magazine, it's just everybody's throwing their hands up in the air. We don't know what to do about worms. And everybody has different ideas, but none of them are working. And the communication that the people that do know, it's not happening. They're not getting the information around. And there's fewer and fewer goats being raised in the United States every year.
Yeah.
And I know why. Fencing and predators, three reasons.
And
fencing, predators, and worms.
Yeah. It's much harder than raising cattle or raising corn or soybean. It's just much, much harder. And I was just stubborn enough and stupid enough to stick with it long enough to figure some of it out. And I still have, I still have things happen.
So do you think there's any hope for a young person if he decided to get into sheep and was willing to learn from someone like you or the other people around? Is it a way that he could buy land and raise a family now? To buy land is the hard part, isn't it?
I don't know. That's a hard question.
Mm-hmm.
I would say without some kind of vertically integrated branding market advantage, probably not.
And the other problem is nobody really wants to farm anymore.
The public wants that farm-to-table, farm-to-fashion identity. The merchandising side is like an alien world compared to the production side. Mm. And doing both simultaneously is
a killer.
They're almost in opposition to one another. You really need a separate team to do one.
Mm-hmm.
We can do it with the hand spinning fleeces because it's a raw product. It doesn't require cash outlay to process it on our part. If we had to invest additional cash to turn it into yarn or clothing, at that point we lose the potential gain. Unfortunately, that hand spinning market is small. It's kind of true with the meat side too. You know, farm to table. If we were to sell lamb as meat, it could work if the buyer took a whole lamb and I could arrange enough ahead of time that instead of delivering one lamb to the butcher, I could deliver 30. But then that shopper has to change the way they shop. They have to say, okay, I have to wait a month and I have to take a whole lamb. So that's a big deal for them. They're used to going to Aldi's and buying one leg of lamb for Easter. So the community-supported agriculture networks where it helps the consumer understand some of those dynamics, I think those are great. Restaurants. I've sold some ewes to a ranch in Colorado. This is a great success story. And they have a contract for their American lamb with Whole Foods. And they're a big operation. So they have an agreeable contract for someone like Whole Foods who has their product branded. Whole Foods is big enough. They can economy of scale.
Handle some numbers.
And keep the cost appealing to the consumer. The other big success story is Anderson Lamb in Oregon. Reed Anderson is a big sheep producer in Oregon. He got so frustrated, multi-generational sheep farmer. Most of these operations are multi-generational, by the way. He got so frustrated of the commodities buyers' complaints that he put in his own USDA meat plant. And he has his own brand of lamb that's in 5-star restaurants around the country, and it's super popular in the Pacific Northwest. It's been a huge success. But, you know, I'm sure you probably spent $1 million on that facility. Yeah. Somehow getting back to some kind of a cooperative, if you could have a cooperative slaughter plant that could do that for several producers, that's the kind of innovation networking we need. You know, I can't invest $1 million in a wool mill or $1 million in a, but I could provide enough lambs for that facility to process for a few weeks out of the year, and other growers could do the same. I think the internet and things like Amazon could come into play where producers could at least do the retail. I think Amazon has a thing where you can sell through them even frozen product as a producer. I need to look into that more, where they take care of all the processing, the sales, and the shipping, and all that.
Well, I get a feeling we've talked about the past, the present, and maybe hints about the future.
Yeah.
Well, listen, this has been incredible. I've got, I'm looking forward to listening to this again and redigesting a lot of it. And you've got cover crops to plant, and I've got hay to bale.
Yep.
So we probably better call it a day, buddy.
Very good.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this session of Let's Get to Talkin', encourage friends out of the range of our low-power station to catch us online. Just Google Sam Stroop, SoundCloud, and the newest and oldest sessions will pop up. If you, like me, have a long day of being focused on my work and life, it's a great day's end to get my mind bent a bit around the life beat of the folks around me. This is Sam Stroop. Catch you next week. Let's get to talking.